ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're about to meet an actor who has made more than 100 films. She has won Best Actress twice at the Cannes Film Festival and twice at the Venice Film Festival. And in March, she was on stage in Adelaide, performing as Mary, Queen of Scots. Can you guess who?
Avec Pierre-Alain, je m'amuse. On vole, on frise.
Hello, this is The Screen Show, brought to you by ABC Radio National. My name is Jason DeRosso, and the actor I'm talking about is the one and only Isabelle Huppert. And this week on The Screen Show, we're indebted to the work of Huppert and another great actress, Sally Field. She won't be joining us, but I will be speaking to the director of Sally Field's latest film, Remarkably Bright Creatures, based on the bestseller, in which she stars opposite an octopus, and the novelist of that book will also be joining us. But first, we're going to Isabelle Huppert. Her new film is inspired by real-life events that were known as the Bettencourt Affair. That was a scandal involving one of Europe's richest women, a French heiress who was also on the board of L'Oréal. And it was, a scandal involving her generous patronage of an eccentric, much younger photographer who was also a writer. He fancied himself as an artist. And there were some dodgy dealings, so the story goes, with several members of Sarkozy's government as well. Now, this is an interesting film because I don't know much about the real-life events that have inspired it, but I think Huppert is playing a quintessentially Hupperian role here. Right from her earliest films, she has always been able to play morally ambiguous characters, almost better than anyone else. And often these roles were in the service of crime films or psychological dramas. And I'm thinking of something like Claude Chabrol's 1978 movie Violet Nozière, in which Huppert played a working-class sex worker who poisons her parents, also based on a true story, by the way. If you haven't seen it, look it up. The costumes in Violet Nozière, these black dresses with sharp architectural collars and hats, make Huppert look like some kind of glamorous praying mantis. Fast forward decades later to Paul Verhoeven's rape revenge thriller Elle, made in the mid-2010s, and Huppert is a middle-aged woman who casually announces to her well-heeled group of Parisian friends who've just sat down to dinner that she's been sexually assaulted. There is this split focus in a lot of Huppert's roles, a mismatch between some kind of violent reality or act and a surface beauty or poise. There's a dissonance too between power and vulnerability that plays out in various ways across her career again and again. So let's get to this latest film, which is called The Richest Woman in the World. It's not a drama, it's a kind of comedy, but without any real punchlines, and it's set in a world of upper-class taste and restraint, embodied by Huppert herself, who plays a cosmetics heiress named Marianne. There are shadows creeping across this land of plenty. Her husband's shameful acts of collaboration and anti-Semitism during the war, for example, not to mention some dodgy dealings in conservative political circles now. But Marianne seems able to compartmentalise and deny. Now, it's worth noting that the real-life Bettencourt affair came to be reported as a story about a lonely older woman being taken for a ride. And that's one way to describe what happens in this film, especially when you take into account Laurent Lafitte's performance as photographer Pierre Alain, who's this Rasputin-like character who infiltrates Marianne's inner circle, indeed infiltrates her family, much to their displeasure. Lafitte as an actor is kind of big. He's also tall, slightly too bulky, you'd say, for his character's wardrobe of summery outfits with flowing linens. And next to Huppert, this physical disparity appears to reflect an obvious power imbalance. When Marianne and Pierre Alain first meet, it's to shoot some new portrait photos for Marianne. And he offers some blunt feedback about her personal grooming, blithely overstepping the mark. And yet, Marianne seems charmed by his audacity. Now, this is not a stupid woman, so her interest in this younger man is kind of a mystery at the centre of this film. Why is she so interested in him? Why is she charmed? Director Thierry Clifford obviously knows his melodrama and knows that beneath the chic and glossy and highly structured everyday life of Marianne, there is a desire for passion, perhaps a reckless desire, a desire for spontaneity, for fun. This film reminds me a little bit of what a filmmaker like the émigré Hollywood director Douglas Sirk was doing in the 1950s, making melodramas about suburban American women and repression. Here, too, just like in Sirk's movies, repression is a symptom of something afflicting the broader community. Now, in this country, in Australia, we tend to tell our true stories about our recent past through a much less ambitious melodramatic lens, often packaging them as a telemovie or a soapy miniseries whose plot lines are dictated by a kind of journalistic instinct about what happened, where, why, and how. The Richest Woman in the World might be no masterwork, but it is a film that's a bit more aware of the buttons it can push, the contrasting textures and emotions and tones that can communicate so much more than the simple journalistic story of it all. And Huppert is an actor who excels in this kind of dynamic on-screen environment. While characters around her are losing their proverbial excrement, she so skillfully plays Marianne as a character above the fray. And it's an unsettling levity, perhaps because Marianne is actually losing her mind, or maybe because she sees the game for what it is. Isabelle Huppert is coming up.
Vous êtes la femme la plus riche du monde. Ça vous évoque quoi?
Riche, le mot n'est pas très joli. Fortuné, c'est mieux. Jérôme, avec ce bouquet, je ne vois pas Guy. Si vous pouviez enlever tout ça, on se croirait à l'aéroport de Honolulu.
Je veux que cette photographie raconte parfaitement la femme que vous êtes.
C'est qui ce photographe?
Pierre-Alain Fantin.
Ce que je veux voir, c'est une héroïne.
Il a une réputation épouvantable.
Je ne photographie pas les gens, je les emporte.
Et voilà.
Ça me gêne.
Mais arrête de glapir, Guy.
Oui, c'est exact, vous glapissez.
Isabelle Huppert, welcome to the Screen Show.
Hello.
This is a film inspired by a real life case. I was wondering to what degree you researched the case itself to prepare for this role, or do you see this role as being separate to reality?
It was quite separate from reality. In France, we knew the end of that story. And the good idea by Thierry Clifford, the director, was to consider doing the story from the beginning that we didn't know. You know, those two people met long time ago, before the story ended up and becoming public and becoming a big scandal because of the money involved in the situation of this woman who by then was a very old lady. But when they met, of course, the situation was totally different, and it was more interesting to go through the little door of intimacy and to try to make people discover what was what happened in, well, in reality. Of course, that's totally subject to imagination. I mean, certainly the basic canvas is true, but then Thierry Clifford, you know, took some freedom with the screenwriters, and the tone of the film, the tone of the screenplay was very inspiring for the actors, because there was this mixture of cruelty, humor. It's very bright. It's close to the personality of these two people, because not only him was this brilliant and sarcastic, and she was also she was in tune with this way of being. Certainly, I mean, even I'm saying this because from what I heard, I've never met this woman.
You have often played characters whose passions or whose desires make them act in ways that perhaps they don't understand and perhaps they don't reflect on. But you often play these women who are very atypical because of these desires. And I was wondering how you thought this role fits into that theme in your career, because she is a woman who acts, at least for her family, in a way that's incomprehensible.
Well, I try to make her as comprehensible as possible and try to, it's not that I really thought a lot about it. I think it was all clear when I read the script, just to make the viewer understanding why she was attracted to this man and why he was attracted to her, because it's not only one-way relationship. I mean, there was a reciprocity in that relationship, and obviously she was also she was very smart, and she wanted to have some a good life and some good moments. I think she goes from happiness to joy when she meets him. Another door opened for her in her life, and she's not resented and shown like a victim, and it's not like she was unhappy. She's the richest woman in the world, and she's certainly, in a way, she's happy, but it's a door open to a new dimension of life for her. And in fact, what's interesting in the film is that, for example, about money, even though at some point money is going to pervert everything, including the family relationships, including kind of a threat to the economical situation of the company. It's a whole system. It's a whole ensemble that happens to be threatened by this relationship. But at the beginning, she decides to give him this money. And this is this initial movement of money from her to him, and not him trying to rob her. It's very important because it's really her will, it's really her decision, and also a way for her to be almost like she was flattered, that it gives her the possibility almost to become like a mécène, you know, someone who is going to be responsible for his artistic accomplishment. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering about also what she found in him, because of course we should point out that this is a character who is very coarse, who is sometimes very vulgar, but he's a lot of fun. And I'm wondering if tell me about that attraction, because on one level it's potentially as a kind of, it's almost a chaste love affair. On another level, maybe there's a maternal aspect. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, no, I don't think so. Not maternal, no. But she, something is certainly between love and just a friendship and a friendship attraction. It's something more ambiguous that we had pleasure to show in the film. But that's totally subject to our imagination for us actors. But certainly, yes, there is some kind of vulgarity, and she likes that. She's totally thrilled and excited by this. She has a great sense of humor, and that's all. And but then the situation, it starts more like a comedy, and then gradually goes more into like a Shakespearean tragedy when family interests and economical reasons are being involved, so it makes the situation much more tricky and edgy.
I was wondering, you've just come off stage in Adelaide doing playing Mary Queen of Scots, and I'm thinking someone in the family refers to him, Pierre Alain, as Rasputin, and I was wondering if in a certain way this character almost becomes like a Shakespearean slightly mad monarch at a certain point. Or maybe she's seen that like that.
Yeah, you can also think about the Pasolini theorem. I mean, one of the characters who goes and shatters the whole equilibrium of the family, like he was literally dropping acid and makes everything very, very dangerous and very questionable. Yeah. But again, there is a total complicity between the two of them. It's not she's never a victim until the end, and that's probably more far from reality, because at the end of her life, of course, she was suspected of losing her mind and being very weak, and terrifically fine in the film, you know, until the end, you know, we remain on someone in control.
What do you think the film is saying about the French? I'm not sure that what the term is, the haute bourgeoisie, is it? I mean, it's the upper class. And yeah, because there's this thread running through of anti-Semitism and collaborationism during the war, during the Vichy government. You know, the character's husband has this dark past that he's rehabilitated himself, however.
No, well, it certainly says something that everybody knows about that family. It doesn't mean that all wealthy family were anti-Semitic and collaborators. It doesn't. A film is never such a general statement. It's focused on this family in particular, but this family, who happens to be a very important and famous family because of the economical situation. Yeah, but we all knew that her father was collaborator and far from the right. Collaboration during the war, but that's part of a dramatic element important in the film, because when the photographer reveals that, especially in a meal family, in a very private situation, of course it's like a bomb in the family. But she finally accepts him saying that. Of course, at the beginning she's cross and she's really touched by this, but then finally she accepts it, because maybe she knows that it's the truth and she doesn't see why the truth shouldn't be revealed. But yeah, but it's not a revelation in the film, because we in France we knew about that past of that family, but it reinforces the strength of the relationship between her and him, because even him saying this, she goes beyond this and they keep good friend in a way after this.
You and Laurent Lafitte worked on Verhoeven's L together.
Yeah, we were together, so we know each other quite well, and we were enjoying very much working together again, because really, yes, and it's wonderful to work with, and so it was all very easy. But the whole group of people around us also was, I've been working more or less with all the other actors, and we were really a good team, a good company, a bit like we were, if we were doing a small theatre play. I mean, not a small, a theatre play.
Well, is there anything similar, do you think, between Elle, which was about a rape, but it was also about a powerful woman, and it was about power and sex, obviously. This is a very different film tonally. But did you discuss at all any similarities between the two films, given that you were working once again with him?
It's a totally different kind of relationship. But of course, yes, it's two people collide together, and you see the side effects of that. But it's obviously very different, because, well, yeah, one could tell in a way that it's a mental rape, you know, stealing the money as the story goes by, and of course the rape is physical and totally different. I mean, that's the whole point of that relationship. That's people when finally the family decided to accuse him. Yeah, it was because he was taken like someone who was literally trying to steal her and steal the family in a very violent way.
I read somewhere that, in fact, the director said there were something like 70 different costumes for your character in this film, and this was to display her wealth and the fact that she had this marvelous wardrobe. I'm wondering if what that's like for an actor when you have so many different costumes, because you've been in so many roles where the costumes have been so excellent and they've been very iconic costumes, you know, like going back to Violet Noisette and films like that. Does it affect you at all when you have to change costumes so much with a character?
All the costume changed matches a specific situation. So there is a way of being elegant and being a businesswoman, and then you play on the color, because her jacket is very feminine and very bright, and she's sitting among all these men dressed in black, for example, as an example among others at the So it also fits the various situations she goes through, and instead of being always dressed in the same way. But there is another interpretation which I did to myself, because the clothes and the hair is very, in the initial meeting, is very important, because he doesn't like the way her hair is, and he doesn't like the way she's being dressed. So you can imagine that the clothes are especially important, and she tries to be as elegant as possible whenever she meets him, and that's a possible interpretation. But and then apart from this, it just matches and fits all the different situations.
He gives her a makeover, as it were, as we say.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the relationship between your character and the daughter. Is there a similar relationship in the real life, in the life of the real character?
Yeah, that's it's the secret for nobody, that the situation, of course, because that's then when he was accused, it was through the daughter, and because that relationship only emphasizes the negative relationship between this mother and the daughter. When the mother says, "You want to know if I love you?" The thing is, I'm not sure I ever loved you, which is very difficult to hear for a daughter. But it was, always all known and public that this relationship was very difficult, of course. And this relationship was almost like she was like this man better. That's what in the film, better than her own daughter. And that's difficult to accept.
Finally, this does have a comedic element to it, and there's a lightness more than comedy, but there's a real lightness to this film.
Lightness and also cruelty too, because the comedy always goes with something very light, but also very often, not all the time, not most of the time, but very often it goes also with certain of cruelty, something, very harsh, which gives more substance to the comedy, more to the comic aspect of the film.
I get the feeling you enjoy comedy. I mean, you've done so many heavy, very dark films, but I get the feeling you have a sense of humor. There's something comic in so many of your films, I think.
Yeah, I think there is something comic in all the films, in a way. I mean, behind comedy, you always have drama, and behind drama, you always have comedy. And it's really something I never really cared doing comedies or doing dramas. For me, it's always, even in The Piano Teacher, for example, you do have many moments of not comedy but of humor, and it's so you can always put this in all films: drama in comedy and comedy in dramas.
Isabel Huppert, it's been a real pleasure and an honor to speak to you once again. Thank you.
Thanks you very much. Thank you very much.
The great Isabel Huppert, who stars in the frothy but full-bodied The Richest Woman in the World, which is previewing this weekend in Australian cinemas and then releasing wide around the country next week. You're listening to The Screen Show, brought to you by ABC Radio National. I'm Jason DeRosso.
I can deduce that the cleaning lady and the juvenile share a similar affliction.
I wish you could tell me how to move on.
I honestly don't know what the hell I'm doing.
I know the feeling.
There may be potential for mutual repair.
What the hell?
Go ahead. He won't hurt you.
Clearly, I've been living under a rock for the last 3 or 4 years, because until a couple of weeks ago, I had never heard of the best-selling novel, Remarkably Bright Creatures. But here I am now, telling you about the Netflix film adaptation of this novel, which was the debut book by Shelby Van Pelt, came out in 2022. And one of the fans of this book, as you'll hear, was Sally Field. Sally Field plays the lead in the film adaptation, which is directed by Olivia Newman. Now, Newman adapted another bestseller a few years ago, a massive bestseller called Where the Crawdads Sing, a murder mystery romance about a young woman set in the marshes of North Carolina. And I was a little mixed on that film, but I think it had some strong elements. And Newman, in particular, was really adept at leaning into the magic realist possibilities of both the setting and the story. Well, it turns out she's back with another film where nature and a female-led storyline intertwine in some pretty emotionally intense ways. Sally Field plays an aging widow who works as a cleaner in an aquarium. She's also never gotten over the death of her son, so there's a lot of tragedy in her life. I won't reveal anything further about that, but it is important to mention that she has a companion at work. The novelty of this film is that a significant portion is narrated by an octopus who observes Sally Field's character, whose name is Tova, from a tank. And it turns out that this octopus has quite a perceptive take on human behaviour, which becomes especially relevant when Tova befriends a young man who's new to town and drifting through life. He, by the way, is played by Lewis Pullman, Bill Pullman's son. Remarkably Bright Creatures is another example of a film working with the expressive possibilities of melodrama. Although here, it's not so much in the service of social critique. This is a weepy with an unashamedly sentimental emotional payload. And the result is a solid, well-acted, slightly formulaic telemovie about family and grief and love. And sometimes that's all you want to watch, curled up on the couch on a cold day in autumn. The director and the novelist coming up.
Of all the humans, I suppose I mind the cleaning lady the least.
Feeling a bit antisocial tonight? I know the feeling. But you can't hide from me. I hope you got some fresh scallops today. I told Terry you must be sick of that frozen halibut. Ugh.
Oh, you have no idea. Unlike the rest of her dull species, we share some similarities. We both prefer the night. We enjoy our solitude.
Hello, my lovelies.
Like me, she has a distaste for wolf eels.
God. Thanks.
And sticky floors.
Shelby and Olivia, welcome to The Screen Show.
So great to be here.
Now, Olivia, I spoke to you for your last film, and I'm thinking here we are again with water and a kind of female-led story, if I could describe it as that. Can you tell me what attracted you to this project?
I mean, the story is so incredible. I was sent the book by a producer I loved who made my first movie, and we've been trying to find another project to do together. He told me Sally Field was attached to play Tova, and that there is an octopus in the book that has a point of view and speaks. And I thought, I gotta read this. But what I loved, what really pulled me in, was the relationships between Tova and Cameron and Marcellus, and understanding that they're all sort of going on a similar journey, even though they're at different ages, different phases of life, they're different species. And I just felt that that was such a relatable experience. And it touched me in a very personal way where I was in my life at the time of needing this book to say there is joy after grief. And there is, you know, it's never too late to find happiness again.
Shelby, what does sort of shifting the perspective outside of the human species and placing the perspective and therefore, you know, the reader and now the viewer's minds into the mind of an octopus do you think? What is this device about? How did you come up with it?
Well, it's great fun is, I think, originally why I was drawn to it. You know, I'm a self-taught writer. I didn't go to school for writing fiction. I had a whole other career before I ever wrote one single word of fiction. So, you know, I was trying to think of like, you know, you think, what kind of stories do I like to read? I like to read things that are a little bit out there, a little bit silly, a little bit fun. And when I was, you know, trying to sort of teach myself how to do this, I was just like, well, this is entertaining. I remember watching, you know, videos on YouTube of octopuses doing kind of like mischievous things and just thinking of a fun, that would be a fun voice to write. And it really wasn't anything deeper than that at that point. It was just like, I'm trying to play around with this whole creative writing thing, and this is great fun. It is very gratifying to step outside the human perspective and be able to kind of like judge humans a little bit and kind of like, you know, you shift backward and look at us sometimes. And we're ridiculous species in a lot of ways. Mm. And it was very freeing to allow Marcellus to sort of, you know, just lean into that.
I also think that, there's something that filmmakers return to again and again that I think shows the pull or the attraction of underwater life. You know, I don't know if you've ever read there's a book on Rossellini that talks about his early film experiments where he had this tank full of fish and he was making these underwater kind of short movies, I think they were, with fish but he would eat them at the end of the day. So it would be a double barrel kind of, not familiar with that.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not, no. And there was no, actually, we had a mandate on the set. There was no octopus to be eaten by
anyone. Is this a real octopus, by the way? I mean, I assume there's CG, but you haven't anthropomorphized, if that's the word. Yeah, that's the word. The octopus. I mean, it seems like a real octopus or a CG-enhanced octopus. What is it?
I love that you're asking that question. That is kudos to my VFX team. it's a mix.
Yeah.
We found an octopus. And then we created a CGI octopus that was as close as we could get to an exact replica of her so that we could use them interchangeably.
Let's talk about Sally Field, because I think why this film works as well as it does is that Sally is so good on screen. She is so 110% committed to the emotional truth of this film and to all the scenes she has where she's caring for Marcellus the octopus, pouring her heart out to Marcellus the octopus, and the octopus is not talking back. We hear the voice inside the octopus's head, but she is so. I think this film really shows what a great actor she is. That you really believe it, and also her screen presence is as sort of adorable now in her 70s as it was, you know, as a teen in Gidget.
Yes, it's true. She has an incredible. She just has an incredible face. There's so much that you can read into her eyes. There's always so much going on in her head. I always say her brain moves so fast. I felt like I was always just trying to keep up with it. But Sally, she was part of the project before I came on. And she, you know, was having dreams like she was Tova. She knew Marcellus deep, deep in her soul. She, you know, every detail of the character, of the world, of this story, Sally had in her mind. And she was so committed to the truth always.
Why was she so committed? Hold on, but why was she so committed to this project before it, you know, before you came on board even? Was she on board in some executive producer capacity or did she just love the book? I mean, Shelby did.
She loved the book.
Really?
Yeah.
When did you meet her, Shelby? Were you kind of, you must have been so impressed that Sally Field wanted to be on the movie of your book.
I mean, I kind of feel like in some way, it's literally a dream come true because when I was writing the book, I often visualize my characters when I'm writing. I think of my job as the fiction writer is kind of to just follow them around and see what they do. So I have always a face in mind. And I kind of used Sally Field when I was drafting it as the stand-in.
Really?
Really, 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 really. And so for this to come full circle and have her, you know, proactively be interested in it, I mean, it wasn't like we went and hunted her down and badgered her into doing this. Like, she wanted to do this. it's wild to me. It's like some sort of proof that there's like, you know, the universe has its ways or something. I don't know. But she truly is just the perfect Tova. I cannot respect her enough for the care that she put into, you know, a character that's really dear to me. I mean, the Tova character was sort of based on my grandmother. So it's a very, very important character to me. And I can't imagine entrusting Tova to anyone else.
So Olivia, when you come on board as a director, how do you, I mean, obviously you're dealing with the one and only Sally Field, who's such an experienced actor and is personally, you know, invested in this story. How do you approach directing someone like that?
I mean, it was a collaboration, you know, from the script stage. She read every draft of the script and gave notes and we talked through things. And I remember, I will never forget once being in her house after one version of the script. And there were things that were not in the script that she loved from the book. And she just began reenacting the entire book, doing all the different voices of all the different characters. And I remember sitting there and thinking, no matter what else happens in my life, I will never forget this experience, because it was like watching one of the greats perform the play version of this book in front of my eyes. But it was really about trusting her instincts and collaborating and being open, you know, to a conversation around ideas and just, sharing, like bringing her into the house I chose for Tova's, making sure she got to walk around it and give us any thoughts she had about, you know, set dressing even, or what would be on that coffee table. Oh, you crosswords. Okay, we'll make sure there's crossword puzzles there. And, you know, she was very, she was an incredibly collaborative and opinionated partner in it, and sort of allowing that process, to be part of our process.
What did she relate to in particular? Did she like that this is a particular depiction of a woman at a certain age and going through those sorts of challenges on various levels, reuniting with younger generations of a family, potentially thinking about grief and all of that? Was it a kind of interest in animals?
Yeah. I mean, you'll have to ask Sally for her response to that, because I wouldn't want to speak on her behalf. What she did say to me about one of the things that she really connected with was the relationship between humans and animals. And she had just gotten her first dog during COVID, and she'd never had a pet before. The pets they had belonged to her kids, and they were her kids' pets, but this was her dog. And I remember her saying to me, you know, I see the world differently now when I go on a walk with Dash. I understand the world through his eyes. And since finishing the film, I got my first dog, and now I understand what she was talking about. And that, that experience she had first time really connecting with an animal, I think she really loved that aspect of the book. But she could, I'm sure, tell you more directly about what
I haven't got her. They didn't give me the great Sally Field, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, that's what she has expressed to me. I don't know if she's shared anything else with you.
Damn. No, and I would not be able to guess on her behalf. But, you know, I think, you know, for me, one of the things that I love about the character of Tova, you know, long before it was being translated to film, was just that, like, I feel like sometimes women characters in books, we tend to want to make them over the top.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially in film, whenever you have a woman who maybe is a little bit older, they're always like crazy or, you know, just kind of caricatures.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to write an older woman character that felt like an older woman character you would know, like someone you would know in your life, not like a caricature. And that is always the hardest thing to do as a fiction writer, is to make my characters feel, on the one hand, completely real. This is your neighbor. This is your family. You know this person. But they also have to be a little bit larger than life in order to really be engaging. You know, but I wanted to really err on the side of not making Tova a caricature. And I have no idea if that is part of what drew Sally to it. But, you know, that's what I've always loved about it as just a role from the start when I was writing the character.
Yeah.
Well, Shelby and Olivia, congratulations on this collaboration. And thank you for speaking to me on The Screen Show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Director Olivia Newman and novelist Shelby Van Pelt, Remarkably Bright Creatures is streaming on Netflix. Almost time to go. Before I do, a quick heads up about an 80s indie classic that is back in cinemas, a film set on Sydney's streets when they were meaner, less expensive, and probably a lot more fun. The film is called Going Down, and it's been restored. Producer-director Hayden Keenan has managed to get it back out on about 20 screens around the country, so chances are it's on a screen somewhere near you. Going Down. Okay, time for me to get out of here. Thanks as always to Sarah Corbett, the producer of The Screen Show, and to ABC Radio National's arts editor, Rhiannon Brown. I'm Jason DeRosso. Bye for now.
Your money from, huh?
I know where it came from. I just want to find out where it went.
Nothing lasts forever, kiddo.
I know what I want. And I'm gonna get it. 'Cause I'm going down. Going
down. Bloody heterosexuals!
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.